Welcome back to another exciting episode of Angel Insights, the show that delves deep into the world of angel investing, learning from some of the top business angels and their underlying portfolio companies. I'm your host, Tom Britton, co-founder of Syndicate Room, creators of the Axis Venture Fund, and a special shout out as always to the team at Master Investor for helping us put this show on. Now enough from me, let's get into the episode. So today I'm joined by the incredible Sylvia Ma. Sylvia is originally from Venezuela, but obtained her PhD in molecular marine biology from the University of California, San Diego. She's also the founder of Stella Labs and Stella Angels, as well as the co-founder of Ad Astra Ventures, a gender lens investment fund focused on backing more companies with at least one female founder. On today's show, we're going to learn a bit about her background and her approach to angel investing, as well as examine some of the parallels between angel investing and molecular biology. Sylvia is a big advocate for getting more women investing into startups and backing more female-founded companies, so we'll talk about what more needs to be done in the U.S. to see that happen. Sylvia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
You've got such an interesting background. I thought we would start towards the beginning and maybe look at your studies, because we've had a few people on the show who have been PhDs, but none in molecular marine biology. Can you give us a little flavor for what you were studying and what led you to study that?
Yeah, thank you for that. It's kind of rolling it back to the beginning. So I love that. You know, when people know me now as an investor and, you know, in the startup world, I say, I'm also a scientist. And they're like, what? What is it? So I always say I'm a recovering scientist and I love it. People say, would you go back to it tomorrow? And I said, well, if I have a fully funded lab with postdocs and grad students and maybe a research analyst or something like that, oh, yes, I would. But the fully funded is the piece that
is the hard part. Yeah.
Is the hard part, right? So yeah, molecular marine biology, I landed at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography because I love marine science. So as an undergrad, I went to every single marine lab I could, Stanford's marine lab, Cornell's marine lab, University of Washington's marine lab, and I loved studying invertebrate embryology. So all the invertebrates that you see out there, the little sea urchins and the slugs in the ocean, all of those, I really loved that piece of the development of those animals. And then the other classes that I took were more of just like invertebrate zoology. I love invertebrates. Who cares about the vertebrates out there? But invertebrates, I thought they were very fascinating about how they broadcast spawned in this big ocean. How do they find each other? Like, what is a development pathway? I was very, very curious, right? So when I was looking at grad school, I was looking at all of those labs that had those capabilities because I really wanted to research that raw science, that raw data, really great insights. So I found this professor at Stanford, who actually was as a professor at UCSD, and he wanted me as a grad student. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so humbling and awesome. I'll take it, right? So we talked, I wrote a research grant and I received it. So that's really big. And that's a little bit of a theme of my career is there's an opportunity. I'm going to write a grant or write something to receive funding. And then I did receive it for 3 years and he goes, come on in, right? So really great start of my graduate career. So marine molecular biology is basically studying the molecular aspects of a marine organism or marine something. At Scripps, I studied sea urchins and the fertilization of them. And at the molecular level, the fertilization proteins that allow a sperm and an egg to find each other in the open ocean. So I lit up sperm to find out what, yes, it is true. My kids were like, really? What? No, ew, mom, don't talk about that. But it is true. And then we really looked at the species specificity of each of the sperm to see how do they find each other? How do they stay as species and propagate that way? So that was my whole entire 7 years of my PhD at Scripps.
I have to ask, what were you hoping to find doing that or how to translate that into something else?
Well, the lab was funded by the NIH. So to be able to have homologous systems and homologous means the same systems, the same proteins, DNA and protein levels between a sea urchin and humans is not that much of a difference on the DNA level. There is differences, right? But proteins fold the same way as well. So DNA to proteins fold the same way. But to get a massive amount of sperm from a human is hard, and it has a lot of intricacies. But if you can inject a sea urchin, you can inject 100 of them, and you get a ton of raw material that you can use to do these protein analyses or DNA analyses to find out at the sequence level or at the protein level, what are they doing? How do they fold? How do they crystallize? What are they doing? How do they behave? So that you can say, okay, in the human system, they might behave this way. And we have found that they're very homologous. So that, let's say somebody who is challenged with infertility or something like that, there is a correlation there. Therefore, those types of scientists that work on the human system can have a better place to start, or they have some great other research that they can tag onto what they are learning.
I'm going to be honest, I never expected to be talking about sea urchin sperm.
I know.
Investing.
You welcome.
How do you go from that to angel investing? There's quite a few scientists who go down the path of forming a business and selling it or not, or joining, say, a VC to get up experience. But you kind of have a different path to the investing world. So talk us through that, because I'm sure it's just as fascinating.
Very different path as well, but really interesting. And also, as a woman, my path is intersectional with family. So I always talk about this because everybody's like, how do you do it? I don't know. Every single day is a challenge with three children. But after I finished my PhD, I was like, okay, well, they're going to go to my postdoc. I'm going to go do the faculty route, you know, go down that route. Because I was definitely like a total science geek. I loved it. I would love to keep on going. And I was writing a grant to be able to learn about the egg side of the sea urchin, you know, sperm and egg recognition.
So as a postdoc?
Yeah, postdoc in looking at the eggs. And it was up at UC Santa Barbara. Fantastic researcher there. I really wanted to work with her. We were collaborating. She didn't have a lot of funding because she was, you know, kind of early in her career. I'm like, wow, I can work underneath a woman. This is awesome. But did not receive that grant. So of course, you don't get the funding, very similar to startups. Don't get the funding, you can't do the postdoc. And at the same time, intersectionality of family and career is I had a 2-year-old son who's special needs. So he has cerebral palsy, he's autistic, he has mitochondrial disease as well. So that's a degenerative disease of the mitochondria. And we didn't know if he was going to thrive or not at 2 years old. So as a mom, I like, you know, tiger mom, I'm like, I'm going to have this child survive and he is going to walk. And he was always at Children's Hospital here in San Diego. So about 4 days a week, I was always down at children's therapies, all that stuff. So when I thought about it, I'm like, oh gosh, I need to stay in San Diego. I need to take care of my child. How in the heck am I going to do this? So I reached out to a couple of colleagues. Again, networking is super important. Some of my colleagues and one professor said, you know what? I know that you do really good in teaching. You do really good at community building. I really have a couple of dollars, a couple of thousands of dollars to be able to launch a program for K-12 education in sand. And because he said, you know, a lot of people collect sand across the world. So I know that there's probably some listeners out there that have collected sand. So what we did was we created a whole K-12 curriculum around sand so that students can learn how to diagnose, you know, with a microscope, do some analysis, do some pictures, do some all of these things and learn the scientific process, right, of observation, of taking notes, of having a hypothesis of where the sand came from. So when he says, look, I can only pay you for about a year. Can you do this? So for me, it was more of like, okay, I need to stay in San Diego as a mom. My career probably won't go to faculty because I do have 2 children and I don't know what my life is going to look like. And I always say at the time of any decision node that you have all the data that you have, and that's all the data that you have at that time. You can do hindsight is 2020, right? You can say, well, what if I pushed a little bit harder here? Well, I didn't. I have the data that I had. I stepped into K-12 education. So I say that it took a little bit longer there because from there, then I got involved with the engineering school at UCSD saying, okay, engineering students, how can you help me? How can you be a great mentor to K-12 students? And then that landed me a job at the Jacobs School of Engineering at UCSD because they needed somebody who was a recent PhD who could do a program called Teams and Engineering Service. So the servant piece of it is K-12 education, but also working with not-for-profits in San Diego. We worked with senior homes and services. We worked with engineering firms that needed some help from engineers or let's say environmental organizations. So I just basically like jumped into that. And with that, it was like, wow, academia, this is great. I'm still at a university. And lo and behold, also part of that is this piece of startups. Like, how do you start up an idea? How do you start a social innovation company? Do you have an idea? How do you create that idea? How do you do some data around analysis around that idea? So really that scientific process, that scientific method that I was just, you know, it was beat into me for 7 years, but also that I love so much of just that curiosity and that data and that analysis and hypothesizing and getting conclusions and then coming back and doing that full circle again. I was teaching that to undergrads, engineering students, and also graduate students as well. So like, how do you do that, but in the real world with not-for-profits? And then that kind of created another opportunity for me to stay at the engineering school doing commercialization of university technologies. So we went from social innovation with undergrads to grad students with their commercialization of their research, and then also some faculty. So all of that kind of was an evolution of the scientific method to the innovation method to the startup world, and then the business development world, right? Of saying, how do you develop a business? How do you commercialize a university technology? And I was just in it, being an advocate for students, being an advocate for faculty, community organizations, connecting people. All of that was part of what I did. And I think that intersectionality of being a woman, being a mother, really helping students. I'm very motherly. I'm like, okay, so how do we help you? How do we mold you? How do we grow you? And then of course, myself as a Latina, I'm originally from Venezuela and Italian. I'm like, okay, I'm super gregarious. I love community. I love bringing people together. Family is super important. I realize in hindsight, you can have some insights into who you are. Wow, that all came together in a really great way. That's kind of how I started at the genesis of why I went into the startup world.
And obviously, so far, it's been all to do with the university and research and science and spinning out or helping less business-minded people take what they've learned and what they put together and create a business from it. But coming in from the private side and looking at it as an investment opportunity, was there a particular event that made you realize, look, like, it's great to do it as a part of the university, but actually there's more to it from this private side where it's investing your own capital as opposed to mentorship, call it sweat equity, if you will, even though it's not exact, you did more than that. But what was the moment that changed your perspective on that to move into the angel, more private side of it? And not that you can't do both.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the empathy that you get from being an operator in a startup, like I helped about two or three different kinds of startups try to launch during all that time myself, that empathy that you create really allows you to be a very empathetic investor. So that investor persona that I am, I really am very entrepreneurial friendly, but as an investor, I'm also investor friendly because of that piece of trying to conjoin those things and make sure that we do have a return on investment, or how I say return on impact, because I think any startup needs to have an impact driven thesis of some sort. So back to your question, how did I do that? While I was doing all of this research and help and community building, I said, you know what? I really don't have that business acumen. Really, I'm the first person to say, these are my gaps. Hello, people. Teach me. Help me. And what I did know, too, is I know my own way of learning. My own way of learning is if I see a YouTube video or I sign up for a course with three kids now, and I have another child, I was like, I'm not going to be able to do this. I need to sit my butt down in a chair and I need to go through a program, right, physically. So I signed myself up for an MBA. And what I loved about being part of the Rady School of Management, which is at UCSD, is that they really have a really great program that allows you to be curious, to find out more about either life sciences, because of course, San Diego is so great in the startup world and the life sciences and pharma and all of that, or do your own entrepreneurial endeavor. So they're very much in these two realms. Now they have tons of other programs in corporate and all that stuff. But at the time that I went in, which was 2008, of course, that was the worst time to get an MBA and try to get a job between 2008 and 2010.
But you did it.
I did it, right? I really jumped in and said, I really need to know this business acumen piece, the business piece of startups, because I've been doing all these other things with technologies and all that. I got that. Let's go into this a little bit more in depth. And during that time, my third option, one was pharma, one was getting my own business. My third option was going back to Venezuela and maybe taking over my dad's business, which he had an entrepreneurial business in the publishing world. So he published books. He did all of the postage stamps for Venezuela and also all the labels of, let's say, Heinz Latin America. So I said, you know what? He's getting older. I might need to step in. So I'm like, no matter what, I need to get this done. So during the 2 years that I was there, my father did pass away. And so I was like, wow, okay, we're going to probably shut this all down. And that was a family decision. But he also left an inheritance that I did not know at all that he had amassed that. He was an orphan during World War II in Italy. And he immigrated to Venezuela with absolutely nothing after World War II. He was a political prisoner also in Germany. So he basically went back to Italy, found two or three of his family, went to Venezuela and was an immigrant there and created his business there. So in that time, I've been challenged with access to capital. I've seen that women don't get enough. I couldn't get the funding that I needed with the companies that I tried to help launch. At Rady, we were always talking about capital markets, venture capital, especially the underrepresented, especially the women do not get the funding. How are we going to solve this? And I was like, okay, we're going to solve this by community and like bringing everybody together and getting great businesses. And then I'm like, wait a minute. I just got an inheritance that I can make a difference. I can impact this world and know that there is an opportunity that nobody is tackling, and that is to invest in female founders and underrepresented founders. And I said, I've just become an angel investor. I didn't know it at the time of like, thum, 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 right? Yeah. This, but I was like, is this a
spotlight comes on.
Yeah. No, it was more of like, because I'm curious, because also imposter syndrome for women is rampant and is definitely rampant in my mind. I was like, can I do this? Should I do this? I'm going to work until the day I die. But man, can I take this pot of money and be able to impact the startup world? Heck yes. And can I do it? I don't know, but I'm going to find everybody that I can. So I found mentors. I signed up for every single possible angel academy out there, 37 Angels Pipeline. Next Wave Impact Fund was first, Rising Tide Fund. All of these organizations over the last like 10 years, I have taken all of their horses at the very beginning. My biggest mentor was Angela Lee from 37 Angels. She helped me with my first investment. I remember calling her and I said, okay, I don't know what I'm doing, but this is such a great opportunity. And it was very scientific. And she was like, you understand it. And it was really cool because when I talked to the founder, I said, I understand this 100%. He goes, no investor is understanding the science. I can talk to them about what's going on. And I said, no, I totally get it. And I said, I totally understand the business side of it. I'm in. So it was a really neat thing to see this intersectionality of everything that I'm doing. And it was a male founder who was in a university, but going after cervical cancer, so HPV. And so for me, it's very personal. HPV is very personal to me, very personal to all of my colleagues, all of my friends, women that I associate with. So I said, I'm in, but what I really want to say, let's write it somewhere in the thing that you will get a woman CEO in the next couple of years, as soon as you can afford a CEO. And he, sure enough, he hired his first CEO was a woman. So that is the power of a woman investor coming in and saying, I care about this technology. I care about this industry because it is a woman's health solution. And by the way, you need a woman in the leadership position. And get the best that you can after you get this funding, go right ahead. And it's like, sure, I will do it. Help me get that person. So that is the power of your dollars and making sure that you understand where your dollars are going.
A lot of fantastic stories wrapped into that.
Yeah.
I don't want to pick apart too many of them, but you've touched on a few things that are definitely worth exploring. First, you talked about getting in a woman CEO for a product that was targeted at a woman. And I couldn't agree more that you have to have within that leadership team an understanding of the product and market. Because I often find two times you have entrepreneurs who have a great idea or have the great science, but they don't have that connection to what the product and where the product market fit is. And they'll never get that, unfortunately, as much as they want to try and research it, because they can't make that personal connection. It just doesn't work out. And I'm wondering if you've seen other examples of that or if I'm just theorizing and...
No, I think I'm going to tease that apart a little bit, right?
Sure.
If you don't mind. There's two pieces to this. One is, yes, if you're going after a industry or a market that is in the women's health field, you should have somebody or some people on the leadership team or your advisory team that empathize and understand with that customer, right? Again, it could be B2B, which is fine. That's not the customer. The B2B customer is not, let's say, a woman, but it is an organization or let's say a hospital that will provide services to women, and they need to have that empathy as well. So having that piece is really important. However, I think equally as important is that founder needs to have the coachability and the empathy and the awareness that they need to bring somebody different. Because he could have been somebody that said, no, I want to be CEO forever and I'm not going to change and I don't need a female CEO. I'm good. Or he could have said, like he said, and he was more like a faculty. So there's also in the faculty world, some of them want to create, they want to spin out and they want to be the CEO. Awesome. Let's train them to be the best CEO possible. I'm a huge advocate of a scientist can turn into a wonderful CEO. You can have a scientist that understands, hey, I need to learn how to be a CEO and really spin out. But then some faculty want to stay faculty, and that's okay. Let's get them that CEO. Let's get them that person that can run the business. So he had to wait a little bit to be able to find that CEO at the time that he needed her to really take over the business, because she has amazing acumen, and it's called Antiva Bioscience, by the way. And she's just running it so well because she understood how to really commercialize, how to really get this solution out in the marketplace further than he could ever have done. So that empathy and that awareness that you don't have to be there the whole time, that's so, so, so important.
I couldn't agree more. Second point, you talked earlier about impact and making sure that the companies have impact, and definitely ESG and impact. Hopefully they're here to stay and people actually want to do and continue to do well with their investments. But oftentimes people talk about having to analyze an impact venture slightly different than one that doesn't have an impact focus. What have you noticed? And second point to that, like, what are you looking for on the impact side when it comes to the startup? Is it purely with the product or service, or is it the business as a whole? How do you take that apart?
I don't think there's any difference between having an impact and having a return on investment. So you're talking to the choir that believes wholeheartedly that you really do not need to lower your investment return by saying, I want to align my portfolio to SDGs. But there's others that do not believe that, right? So I'm just going to go down the route of looking at investments that can have a very high return on investment and a very high impact. I'm going to go back to the example of Oriana Bruschner, and she is the founder and CEO of AquaCycle. So it is a water purification system that allows for really bad water coming out of any kind of company or any manufacturing facility to go into potable water. So yes, she wants to create, let's say, down the road, something, let's say, a latrine in the third world nation that allows us to do this. But she knows that to be able to really launch this, she has to have those big clients. She has Mars Candy. So the outward flow of their manufacturing is very high candied, let's say, outflow. And then she lets that go through her system. And then we have potable water at the end. Now, you can say that that's a completely scientific process. And she did. She went through the Craig Venter Institute, was in science for, I think it's almost 10 years in science, really hardcore science. And then she transitioned into, hey, I want to spin this out. I want to have a company. How do I do this? So that transition, it was saying, okay, where do I go? Okay, we're going to go after refineries first and wineries and breweries. And then that transitioned into, hey, we can do this for other things, the military and candy companies, right? So that awareness of going into those fields, those industries is what makes that impact-driven hard science be impactful in the world, basically. It commercialized, but then also understanding what are the SDGs that she's going after and being able to communicate that. So impact investors love that type of opportunity. Again, sometimes impact investors are more philanthropists. So you have these people that say, okay, these sets of investors that say, okay, I need to be impact, but I want the return. Then I need to be impact. Okay, not so much return. Or I'm a philanthropist. I only invest in these ones that I'm more familiar with, and I can't invest in these really high-tech businesses because I don't understand it. So people like myself and others, especially Next Wave Impact Fund, we really communicate, how is this possible? How do you really bridge the gap between impact and really hard tech or technologies? We really work together to learn, okay, how do you build a business? How do you communicate that it does have impact and a return?
And for young companies, when they're just starting out, one of the biggest things that I've found with impact is that the measuring of the impact is often quite difficult and resource intensive. So when a company is just starting, what are you expecting to see from that measurement side? Because it's not going to be to the level of a Fortune 100 company where they're spending lots of people and lots of money making sure that that impact is measured to a T. What are you hoping to see from the startup on that kind of report?
I know that entrepreneurs' time is very, very limited. So again, I'm very entrepreneurial friendly as an investor, and I'm also an early stage investor. So you're not talking to a VC that's going to ask different things. I'm going to take that really early stage conversation that I'm having with founders. When founders come to me and say, oh, I want to give away part of my revenue and that's my impact, I'm like, it can't be that, right? It's not that it can't.
You should do it. Just do something else as well.
Yes, because if that's something that it's so tied to revenue, that what about if you don't have revenue, what are you going to do? So I really encourage entrepreneurs to make impact part of their DNA. The DNA of their company is impact. So it's not that you're saying, okay, the DNA of my company is this. Oh, and by the way, I have to get this data for impact. It's more of like the DNA of my company needs to be connected with this impact metric of some sort, because no matter what, I have to communicate revenue and impact at the same time. And even if I'm sold, that DNA stays there and that impact stays there. Because that's very important to me as an investor. If I know that you're going to sell, or you're going to get acquired, or you're going to go IPO, whatever all those options that are out there, right? There's not only three. I want that impact to stay with the company. So if it's part of their hiring processes, great. Make that the DNA of your hiring process, not just, oh, and by the way, we do this. Or revenue, great. And by the way, we give away. No, it's like, why is this important to you? And making sure that it's part of your sustainable growth of your company.
I think we should soundbite that right there, because it's incredibly powerful, but also really insightful for entrepreneurs. They often struggle with, well, how do I balance between the impact side and the revenue side and the monitoring and this and that? And you're right. Like, if it's a part of your DNA, you're going to find a way.
Yeah. And that DNA piece is not just important to me, but for your customers. If even if you're B2B or B2C, if you're B2C, if you're like an e-commerce or CPG business, that consumer is a conscious consumer and they will want to know that impact statement. So that's part of your DNA. Like, how do you source it? How do you know all this stuff? That's important to them. So that's part of your marketing. The B2B is like, well, you're going to be aligned to that business that really cares about sustainability. And they're going to be like, okay, our sustainability is tied to your sustainability. So we might as well have this path of data analysis or data gathering, because you are seeing this as a win-win for both of you and a win-win in your values, right? So you want to have values aligned customers B2B, and that helps you be more successful. You see how that plays into this piece of being part of your DNA.
Yeah, and the authenticity of it, definitely. I feel like we've got a decent idea of what you look for in the companies. And so I want to jump a little bit. You talked a bit about earlier on joining all these other networks and learning as much as you can. And you've come a long way since then, having created a nice portfolio of investments. But you've also started your own angel network. So what was the reasoning behind that? And tell us a little bit more about how you differ with your angel network than what's been available before.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily different. I think it's complementary to all of the female angel groups that are out there. We all collaborate together. We all share deals. We want to empower each other. So it's a very much of a lift by doing and lift others as you climb type of thought process between all of these female angel groups and opportunities. So that's like a caveat before I go into Stella Angels. So in San Diego, there's Tech Coast Angels, which is an amazing angel group and have done wonderful things. They have been so successful. And of course, like LA has another chapter and all that stuff. But what I saw was a lot of women investors or aspiring angel investors. That means, let's say, a lawyer that can be an accredited angel investor, but really doesn't know how to talk the talk, feels a little bit maybe intimidated by going into a big angel group with males and females. They're good with it because they're lawyers. They've been done it for a long time, right? But really understanding the processes and having a network of other women that they can ask questions very candidly. So I saw that there's a need in the marketplace, and I just fill needs. It's not that I needed it, but it was more of my colleagues and a lot of women who were calling me up saying, how do I get involved? What's going on? Do you have any deals? So we just kind of created a group and allowed people to come in. Right now, we re-emerged in January 2021, and we now have about 12 members.
Congrats.
Very small. We want to keep it kind of small because it's really San Diego based, SoCal. We have some members who are across the nation because we're virtual, right? So it's been really cool to be able to, through the pandemic, get women across the nation to join Stella Angels. But again, we are really women to women investing, industry agnostic at very early stage. So women who want to invest in seed plus companies and want a huge network, they're going to join other angel groups. And that's awesome. Go find your tribe. Trust is the most valuable currency for an angel investor, right? So if you have that trust, if you have that network that allows you to ask questions vulnerably and interact with people, build connections, find good source deals based on your investment thesis, that's magic.
Definitely, definitely.
Right? And you can't do that necessarily with a big organization for some women, and some women thrive on that. So we created it. It's been a wild ride.
And actually, I think I just heard this, that there was a recent exit.
Oh, yes.
Tell me this a little bit about the company. And if you can remember, what was the first meeting with them like? Like, were you like, yes?
There's a whole story on it. The exit is not from Stella Angels. So let me just clarify. It's an exit of my own portfolio. Some of the ladies who are part of Stella Angels did go in really early, and also Ad Astra Ventures invested in Eucora. So the exit is Eucora and was founded by Jenna Ryan and Spencer Gordon, and really exciting company in the UTI space. So it is a prevention drink mix first, and then it now has a whole plethora of products for UTI prevention, of course, in the women's health space. So of course, as a woman investor, I'm like, yes, this is amazing. But it wasn't started that way, of that interaction. I also run an accelerator called Stella Labs. I started about 10 years ago. Now we have an executive director, Raven O'Neill, who runs it. And what we do is two things. One, programs for entrepreneurs and access to capital events. We actually just had our Women's Fast Pitch over the summer, and we have our annual Women's Venture Summit in September every year. But with that, we really care about access to capital. And that access to capital is pitch competitions, opportunities for entrepreneurs to get in front of investors in multiple different ways. That's a typical thing that accelerators do. So go backwards about 4 or 5 years. We always glomp on to anything that we can. So the US government had a program called Innovate Her, and it was part of the SBA, a Small Business Association of the United States. And what they did was say, okay, whoever wants to get a license to do an Innovate Her competition regionally, let us know. So they, I think they got like 200 or more licensees. And we as an accelerator said, hands up, we'll do this. We became a licensee. We had the pitch competition, and it was just, you know, a call for applications. And Eucora was one of the applicants, and our judges picked her to be the top five, her and a couple of other founders. We had a live pitch competition when we could be in person, and then we had a set of judges pick her as the winner of the Innovate Her competition that Stella Labs led. And our piece was to write a 2-page due diligence report, send it to the federal government in Washington, D.C. And of course, I pitch prepped Jenna. She's brilliant and magical and amazing. She's shown really for the judges. And that's kind of how I started to have a conversation with her. You know, for me, it's like all startups are amazing and I want them all to shine in their own way. But when you have something like this product that is for women's health, that she understands that she has growth every single month, just amazing, amazing founder, solid in what she's doing. She actually did have like 9 UTIs in 1 year and said, I need to fix something. Her boyfriend at the time, who is Spencer, who became her husband, he was a chemist. So he goes, I'll create something. How cool is that, right? Yeah. Is empathy of people and a guy saying, okay, I'll help you, and created something. And then that's how Eucora was born. I mean, that origin story is phenomenal, yeah. Right? Then you create something, people are buying it. What? There's a market for it. You're just like, okay, check, 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 all the check marks. So she went to Washington, D.C. She won the national competition. She won a grant from the Sarah Blakely Foundation. So you see all those check marks of external validation than just me as an investor or a group. Then Ad Astra Ventures was formed 3 years ago, about a year after she pitched. And she became one of our first cohorts of our accelerator at Ad Astra Ventures. And we invested in that accelerator. We invest money for equity. So we received equity and we gave her funding, went through our accelerator. Then after the accelerator, all three of us partners, Vidya Dinamani, Allison Longpatine, and myself, invested individually into her company. And then after that, we had a couple of these Stella Angels that were loosely associated in San Diego also invest in her. So this is a community of women who supported her by writing checks. And then now a couple of years later, got the exit, and it's a win for San Diego.
It's fantastic. And it's great to hear, because obviously when you think of the States, you're like, oh, Silicon Valley or New York and a little bit about LA. But I grew up in LA. San Diego is a favorite place for me to visit. And obviously the surfing in San Diego is quite good as well. So good to see it's on the startup map properly.
Of course we are. And I mean, we are such a tight-knit community in San Diego. We share deals. We champion each other as investors and as entrepreneurs. That's why the story is convoluted, because it's like, okay, this person did this and this check and this, that's opportunity. All of that creates that community, that ecosystem of growth.
And we're seeing that here in the UK as well, because usually people are thinking London, Cambridge, Oxford, a little bit of Edinburgh, but now there are these other kind of growth hubs in the regions. And it's good all around for the economy, but also for innovation in general, because it's different ways of thinking and bringing more angels into the game. And it's positive.
Yeah. And I always say innovation is found everywhere. So let's get them all connected. Let's have access to capital, even if it is in a different city, San Diego, and access to capital. Like, that's why I get connected to all of the angel groups across the United States, because I'm like, okay, San Diego, we have a great deal. What do you think? Call up. What about this? What about that? That innovation is, it should be supported and championed in your local ecosystems for sure.
Definitely. Ucor is obviously such a good success story. But clearly every angel has some not so good stories to share. This is not a section for naming and shaming, but I'd love to hear a bit about one of the lessons learned from maybe when something didn't go so well, what you did learn from that.
Yeah, I think the themes that I see of the ones that have not worked, there's a lot that are still active and good. So I cannot wait, right? I have 55 plus companies in my portfolio. So only now 3 exits. So I need some of these wonderful startups that are really thriving in their markets to really do that next step, because I only get that in return on investment when they sell. But man, are they successful? Yes. Right. So I think that what you're saying about the failure piece is 2 themes come up. One is kind of not having that product market fit. I know that that's really like very usual that people say that, but really, if you don't understand your product market fit, it just won't work. Really taking the time. Sometimes people do like a Kickstarter and they're like, oh yeah, we're going to put it out there and people buy it. And then it's like, wow, the manufacturing doesn't happen. Okay. I sell out on the first Kickstarter and then nobody buys. Right. So that's one thing that I've found is whenever there's not that great product market fit, that you have that churning of customers that absolutely love your product, that's when it gets challenging, right? Like Ucora is a great example. Man, huge community of just people that say, this is transformational. I want more and I want to tell others exactly how I feel about Ucora. When it's not that, when it's like a smaller product that I've invested in and people are not talking about that, you don't have those champions, that's when it becomes challenging. So that's one piece of it. The second one is the coachability of the founder, is that I can do it myself. I don't need any advisors. I'm good. And they chug along and they're doing great work, but they just can't do that exponential growth in the right way. So the more that a CEO and a founder can really know that they can't do it all, they have to bring in the right people, understand your gaps, understand your strengths, build on the strengths. When that is humming, right, that you're like, yes, I have a great team, I'm coachable, I can bring in different people. An investor says, hey, why don't you go down this route? Actually, don't do this decision. And they say, okay, I'll listen to my investor or I'll listen to my mentors. I won't make that decision. And they make the better decision. Wow, that's when you see that company keep on going. Or when they don't listen, it's just harder for them. Those two are the 2 themes that I see as the ones that are being challenged right now.
I feel like coachability is something that is easier to test up front. You can throw a challenging question or throw some stress, if you will, at the founder and see how they react to it. But with product market fit, or even going down that Kickstarter route, which you highlighted, someone can get really motivated. They can tap into their whole social network and treat it like I call it an exercise in payback, like, hey, we're doing this great thing, please just support it. You know, not like buy the product because it's great. So they treat it as this fundraising effort. And then they use that to say like, look, we've got 1,000 people who want this, but really it's not 1,000 people who want it. It's 1,000 people who are like, oh, this guy annoyed me until I backed it, or, you know, it is a friend of mine, so I bought into it. Is there any way that you can test that theory up front? Like, is there going to be a market for this? Because everyone comes to you and they say the market's huge, and then you can go research and you're like, yes, the market's huge. But how do you know this product is going to be able to supplant the incumbents there? What do you do?
One thing that I'm like, that pressure testing is something that I've seen over the years. And it's kind of like something that I've noticed. And I'm like, oh, that is actually a theme and a trend, right? When you ask a founder, have you done any interviews with your customers? And they're like, oh, I'm good. I'm going to do my Kickstarter. I'm going to have a party and everybody's going to support me. I'm like, okay, yellow flag, right? If you say, hey, have you talked to your customers? Can you go out and do some interviews? Like even go to the mall. I don't care what you do, but try to do something. Come back to me in 2 weeks. And they don't come back and they're like, we're good. We're going to do the Kickstarter because we have so many friends. Or you ask them and they say, you know what? Yes, we have sent out a survey on multiple different social media things, and we actually tried to weed out our friends. We know where they're coming from and really understand the data and say, this is exactly where we need to be. And actually, we need to pivot a little bit about how our preconceived concepts were failing us in understanding truly our customer. I'm like, you're going to get there. Because it's not like you're asking about the super early indications. They might not have product market fit at that time, but they're asking the right questions. Instead of saying, I got it. I'm like, wait a minute, you're never going to get to product market fit. But if you do ask the right questions, and if you do pivot, and if you do take those questions and those answers and those insights and motivate yourself to change that product in a certain way, wow, I know you're going to get there. So I think it's more also about investing in the jockey, not the horse. Is that coachability? Yes, you can pressure test it. And that's one piece. And that product market fit, you can also pressure test it by saying, how does that jockey take the feedback that I give them on the product and really understand that there are going to be flaws in your product and be okay with that? Because that product market fit, you'll have to tweak it a little bit. Not yourself as a coachability factor, but that product needs to be tweaked or needs to be marketed in a certain way. And when they have those critical questions and that great conversation with me, I'm like, they're going to get there. We might need a couple more sessions with them and really get that product market fit, but they're open to understand it and they're open to get there. Hopefully that answered your question.
No, it does. It definitely does. It's not loving the product so much that you're not willing to change it.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of people are like, this is the greatest thing ever. And you're like,
and my friends are going to buy it. I'm like, well, that's great. But what about afterwards? Exactly. Right? And I'm like, I love you too. I would want to buy your product. But who are the ones that really will buy it? And how big is that? And even if they give me this $10 billion market, I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Right? Let's talk about it. Let's see what the smaller market is. What's your niche market? What's your entrance? What is your beachhead? Let's talk about that. And when they can talk about that really concretely, saying this is the type of customer, awesome. Like, let's talk about that. They're going to get to that product market fit.
Cool. So now we've got a success and some trends to look out for. I'm wondering if you could go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice, given all of that, when you were starting specifically the angel investing journey, what would it have been?
I think trust my gut. Because at the beginning, I took every single course. I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't know anything. How do I learn? And I think trusting the strengths that you have in your expertise. Like for me, it's the science. I come back. I mean, how many years has it been? So many years, like 15 plus years that I got my PhD. But it always comes back to, oh, wow, you really understand the science. What do you think about this company? And it usually is correct. But I don't really think that it's attached to that. And let's say aspiring angel investors out there, if you're a lawyer, dive into that strength as a lawyer. You know how to analyze things. You have great critical questions. Ask all those questions. Don't say, well, I need to fit into this box of this angel investor. Aspiring angel investors that even have created their own company, exited, you know that industry super well. Dive into that industry. Become an investor in that industry because you can syndicate with other people that know their industries, right? But you know your industry really well. So trusting that gut is what I would say to myself 10, 15 years ago. When I started.
Love that. Before we dive into the quick fire section, you did mention an upcoming event. And if you give 30 seconds on that event, who's it for, where it's at, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, thank you so much. So our Women's Venture Summit is our annual event. It is an access to capital event for female founders and female funders. It is September 17 and 18. It is virtual. So anyone in the world can come. It's a two-day event. You get to do really great panels listening to the female ecosystem and the female economy, but then also due diligence. So we do a gamified due diligence session that you get to hear all of the women who won the women's fast pitches in all six regions of the United States that culminate in that day. You get to hear their pitches. You get a $1 million Starbucks, like Stellar Box, Starbucks, and you get to actually invest those bucks into the companies, and they get a $10,000 investment. So you get to feel what it's like to be an investor. And it's all about community and it's all about engagement of the Women's Venture Summit. So come.
That sounds really fun. And if I wanted to find out more, where would I go?
www.womensventuresummit.org.
I will be going later on. I'd like my bucks.
Thank you. And men are very welcome. I have a couple of founders in my portfolio that are men of color. That can we join the summit? Of course you can, because you get to get that empathy of what it's like to be a woman in this venture space, but also fantastic connections to women who care about impact investing, who care about men of color, who care about underrepresented founders in the ecosystem. So anyone is welcome.
Glad to hear that. I will be going to the website later on and maybe see you on the day.
Thank you.
Let's move into the quick fire question. So just a few short questions. I want to hear the first thing that comes to your mind. So you ready for it?
Yes.
Best book you've read recently, any genre?
Oh my goodness. I knew you were going to ask me that and I totally blanked already. I go back to Arlon Hamilton's book all the time. I read it like last year and the year before. I'm one of her investors. So I love that book.
It's About Damn Time for anybody who's looking for it. It's a great book about her journey. I've got it. Question two. So what's the tech trend you're most interested in at present?
I love artificial intelligence. I think that it's overhyped, but when you really look into it, it's very cool. So don't overhype your startup. Know that it's a great technology.
Fantastic. Something that you've learned recently that's changed how you invest.
I think the one thing is that we're going into creating a fund. So we're really excited about that. So how do you communicate the investment thesis in a way that others can glomp onto it, can really align themselves to that? That is something that is one step above just a data analysis of the economy or trends in markets. It's really understanding what is a deeper meaning of impact, like we talked about already, and what's a deeper meaning of investing in underrepresented founders, or how do you change the thought process of economic growth? So those are the kinds of things that always spark me and then change my investment decisions, just because I'm like, okay, what does it look like in 20 years? Is this investment actually going to make that difference that long term? I didn't think about that before.
I love that. No, definitely important to keep in mind. One last question. You've been doing this startup scene for about 15 years, and you mentioned you've got a long way to go before you give up on it. But we have touched upon some very personal topics with the impact investing and investing in underrepresented founders and a few other things. And I'm wondering, if you were to fast forward 20 years and you look back on the difference that you've been able to make, what do you want to see? What are the few things that you're really hoping you can progress?
Whew, that is like, you know, one of those teary questions. I actually have been challenged by what my assumptions were. So I did a TEDx talk about women and making sure that we get to even 50% representation of women on both sides of the venture table, not just the women founders, because we're at about 20% of founders receiving angel investment and about 5 or below in VC. So I'm like, okay, we're going to get to even 50% representation. And of course, on the other side, the investor side with Stella Angels and Women's Venture Summit, creating more investors, we want to get to even. Somebody challenged me. They said, in your lifetime, you're not going to see that. I was like, what? Wait a minute. Yes, I am, because we're doing so much good work. So I think that what I look back in 20 years is that our generation has created enough buzz, enough impact that we are stronger together, generation from generation to generation to generation. It's not just me saying I did it all or my colleagues say we did it. It's really allowing us to grow together, educate others, collaborate with others. We are stronger together instead of being siloed and breaking those silos, breaking those traditions, breaking the club of investment or the club of startups, right? Breaking it, saying San Diego is great. Women are great investment opportunities and investors. Making sure that that goes along and goes into every generation, that's the win, right? Because that's more of a servant's heart. That's more of a servant leadership approach, right? Instead of saying, okay, we led the way. No, all of us lead the way. Your podcast leads the way to say, yes, I will have a female investor on the podcast. Thank you. And thinking outside the box, right? Everybody has that opportunity to make that impact. And that's what I want to see in 20 years, that everybody's thinking about that.
Well, I think that's a great thought to leave the show on, to end us on. You've been an absolutely wonderful guest, sharing some tremendous insight with us. I do hope that the Venture Summit goes really well. So I hope everyone checks it out.
Thank you.
I hope you get more exits from the portfolio so you can cycle that money again. And I do hope that we can revisit this in maybe 6 to 12 months time, because it'd be cool to see how we both progressed in that time. So one last thank you for joining us today, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that episode of Angel Insights. And for more news about Syndicate Room, follow us on Twitter at Syndicate Room or myself at Tom Britton. And we do, as always, hope you'll join us for the next episode of Angel Insights in a few weeks' time. Until then, bye.